From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We all have food memories, certain dishes or flavors that remind us of something, something our moms made or our grandmothers. The sociologist Jennifer Jordan calls this edible memory. And for a lot of us, it's simple, basic stuff like a TV dinner or a can of SpaghettiOs. For Jordan herself, one of her edible memories is a spice cake she made with her great aunt. Nothing special, it was a mix that came in a box. But in her book, she says these memories sit deep. They're personal, but they're also bigger than that because our food, our sense of taste, creates culture and bonds. Jordan says food isn't just physical sustenance, it's also fundamentally social. She's joining us today to talk about her book called Edible Memory. Join us after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. This is Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. Thanks for downloading this episode of the show. If you enjoy what you hear on Radio West, think about pitching in 10 bucks. It's a one-time donation that'll show up on your phone bill. Text KUER to 85944 and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Most of our food memories are so particular, it's hard to imagine they may play a part in a larger story. Think about a treasured recipe from your grandmother that you cling to, or think about the crab apples in the glen near where you hung out as a kid, or think about a popsicle or a TV dinner or an heirloom tomato. In her book called Edible Memory, Jennifer Jordan says, these deeply individual memories are shaped by the social and material world. And in the book, she explores how our own personal connections to food are also about society's memories and society's practices and habits. We're talking to Jennifer Jordan today about her book. It's called Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. And we're hoping you'll join the conversation. We want to hear about your own edible memories. What foods evoke memories for you? Is there a recipe? Is there a dish that holds a special place in your family? Maybe there's a particular variety of fruit or vegetable that's made its way through your family tree. You can join us at 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Jordan is a professor of sociology and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's joining us today from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio there in Milwaukee. And Professor Jordan, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to begin with Chicago because you write about this early on in the book. I think what's interesting about this is that you didn't really, as you say in the book, you didn't really you came to the idea of heirloom tomatoes and heirloom vegetables and antique apples and all this stuff really later in life. And it really wasn't – you kind of peg it to on some level anyway – going to a market there. I'm guessing it was a farmer's market or some kind of market anyway. Green City Market is where it was there in Chicago. And this was – I'm not sure if this was the beginning part, but this certainly got you thinking.
It did get me thinking. I think several paths were kind of heading toward this book already. But heading to that particular market, it is a farmer's market in Lincoln Park in Chicago. And – walking around in the middle of that big metropolis, looking at these sort of genetically rare and old-fashioned fruits and vegetables started to get me thinking. You know, the contrast between the produce in those bins that farmers had carted in from Michigan, from Illinois, I think possibly from southern Wisconsin, that I was seeing these varieties that I had really never seen in a supermarket and hadn't really paid much attention to before, even though I grew up in California and in the middle of all kinds of agriculture.
But what were you seeing that made you – so you're a sociologist. You're out there. You're seeing this stuff and you're starting to think – because clearly you're thinking differently about it. I mean, you're seeing a bigger picture here. You start to see these patterns. I mean, what is it that you're seeing?
Part of what I'm seeing is people beginning to attach both labels and meanings to material objects. And that's what I do in much of my research, what I've really looked at for 20 years just in different areas. But The whole idea of even calling a tomato an heirloom, to me as a sociologist, that kind of demanded investigation, right? Because you can't hand a tomato down from one generation to the next, right? The tomato itself is so perishable. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done to turn that into an heirloom, both kind of physically and symbolically. So the thing that gets handed down is the seed, and the seed contains that genetic material that's going to make that the next tomato, the next generation of tomatoes. And so I saw that as a puzzle, as a sociological puzzle of bringing those two words together, heirloom and tomato. And so seeing those objects themselves in the city, right, it's sort of far, a little bit far away from the land on which they had grown, made me want to understand, you know, how did they get there in the broadest possible sense, and how did those two words come together?
So you uncover, you write about this, the title of the book, obviously, it's kind of a phenomenon that you uncover, or at least that you you really pay attention to, this idea of edible memory. Explain just what that is. I think we all get it for the most part. At the minute you start thinking about your childhood, there's a food that – or foods that are absolutely connected to – is that what that is?
That is what that is. And so the first part of the book, the prologue, really sets up, I think, the bigger idea of edible memory. I see it as actually a very expansive concept. And so in that section, I write about this – kind of awful Jell-O salad that was handed down in my family.
Wait, it was called seafoam salad.
Seafoam salad, yes. I think the word salad is being used very loosely in that context. So it's, yeah, I'll even list the ingredients, which are lime Jell-O, mayonnaise, cottage cheese, pineapple, canned pineapple, and horseradish, just to really bring it all together. And that got made in four generations of my family. And I think now it's starting to peter out a little bit. But, you know, that's one end of the spectrum of edible memory. The book itself really focuses on heirloom fruits and heirloom vegetables and wants to understand how do we come to see these particular varieties as connecting us to the past, as worthy of preservation, as kind of conveying botanical and cultural information. But I definitely think, you know, as I watched people behave in this way that I came to call edible memory, I also saw that much bigger connection. You know, going so far as to, you know, I knew a teacher I worked with many years ago, there was a particular McDonald's that was very meaningful to her because that's where she and her son would meet after school and have kind of, you know, a chance to have real conversations with each other. So I think it's important to see how broad the concept of edible memory can be. And again, in the book, I carve out one little area to investigate, and that's heirloom fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that, I promise. I want to stick around for just a few moments with the more sort of pedestrian stuff from our edible memories, because I want to have you read a section, because I think it really gets to the essence of the book. But you need to tell us who your great-great-aunt Budur is, because she plays a part in the way you were thinking about this story.
She does. So while I was visiting the markets in Chicago, I was in the middle of beginning to conjure up my second book. I had finished my first book and was at that sort of exciting, sometimes kind of terrifying moment when you really start to create the shape of the next project. And I just kept coming back to her and to her house and her garden. And she was a cattle rancher in Northern California in the Gold Country and grew incredible things in her garden. And it was incredibly self-sufficient, had this enormous enameled cast iron wood stove in her kitchen that's sort of one of my earliest like sound and sense memories, the sound of her stoking it early in the morning before anyone else in the house was awake, and the smell of the newspaper catching fire and her sort of clanking the burner. So she occupies this really kind of, I don't know, sort of emotional and culinary heart of my family. So many of us would all kind of gravitate toward her house. And I think a lot of my understanding of gardens and of kitchens kind of comes from those early childhood experiences at her ranch.
Read the
and
section.
I just wanted to add that when I was thinking about her kitchen and her garden, I was also then starting to think about kitchens and gardens in the plural,
yeah,
right? So
yeah.
Trying that, to understand the sociology.
That's a big theme. I mean, like I said in the introduction, I mean, that was the thing I really keyed on, this idea that we all think about our food memories as so individual, only this is only stuff that we would get. But mm-hmm. that's what the book is about, is expanding the – of course it's personal. I mean, everyone's idea of the perfect apple is different. But it's connected to something bigger. It's connected to – social bonds. It's that thing you talk about, that it's not physical sustenance. It's about something bigger. It's about our culture and about our societies that we create.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. So should I go ahead and read that section?
Please do.
Okay. These memories sit deep. That spice cake, a spice cake that my great-great-aunt and I made together, is etched into my memory and evokes emotions difficult for me to recreate with the most old-fashioned of heirloom produce. The cake mix that we used to make itself no longer exists, discontinued long ago, and visible only in fleeting images on the internet. Our memories of food defy easy categorization. Something happens when we eat. The transformation, even transubstantiation, of these molecules into energy and strength, and sometimes into love handles, spare tires, or what in German is called a life preserver, a Rettungsring. But it can also transform into social bonds and memories, connections within families and communities and larger social groups, as well as stark divisions and distinctions, ways of resisting or oppressing, controlling and rebelling. Food, its production, consumption, and distribution, shapes and transforms a range of places as well, kitchens and dining tables, fields and forests. At the same time that I was revisiting Butter's kitchen in my memory, I was making the rounds of Chicago's farmers markets, tracking down flavors, colors, and textures brand new to me, but deeply familiar to people for whom these were true heirlooms, for whom a particular apple or tomato was as deeply etched into memory as that store-bought cake mix was for me. I am a sociologist, after all, and part of our job is to look beyond the individual, to identify social patterns and their connections to larger forces, these dynamic relationships between the individual and the broader world. I began to search not for a single kitchen, but for patterns, for a multitude of kitchens and gardens and farms and markets, set in a framework of laws and regulations, cultures and habits, landscapes and technologies. I have long been interested in the connections between memory and materiality, between the stories we tell about the past and the material world around us, whether urban space or tomatoes and apples.
It's Jennifer Jordan reading from her book, Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Let's take a call. This is from Kelly in Salt Lake City. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yes, when I first heard the topic of conversation, I was immediately intrigued because, of course, I have these very types of memories etched completely in my mind. I currently live in Salt Lake, but I am from an area of North Texas, and my grandmother lived to be nearly 100 years old, and she would spend hours in the kitchen with me as a child and make what every Texan loves, which is plum jam. In Utah, people like raspberry, but there is plum, and none of us now have the recipe. And we refer to it as the clearest plum jam. We cannot figure out how to make it, and it was from red plums. And when I went to her funeral a few years ago, I asked around, and nobody had the recipe. And I was also told something very sad at the time, was that the 10-year drought in Texas had killed off all the plum trees. And so that was very profound for me, because we would spend time making pie crusts and pies, and I would etch out my piece of crust and make little crackers to bake and then put the jam that my grandmother and I would make together. And at that time, we'd use the paraffin wax because they didn't have the lids.
Yeah. What are you hearing there, Jennifer Jordan? I mean, listen how personal that is. I mean, that's what this is about, isn't it?
Oh, it's so powerful. And that just, that story gets me. And I hear stories like that whenever I talk to people about this research. And to me, like, immediately you can see how this is something so personal, so emotional, you know, a connection between a child and a grandparent, right? It's often a very special bond and sort of rooted in a particular place, in a kitchen in this case. And yet then you connect it to things like a drought, right? Mm-hmm. Like a community sort of remembering a lost recipe, right? A flavor that they can't recreate because the recipe's gone, but then also because the landscape has changed. And I think it can be so easy for us to experience food in a way that's disconnected, both from the people who produce it and then from the places where it's produced. And in that story, you get both, you know, that individual personal connection and sense of loss, right? This is sort of edible memory, but that's on the brink of forgetting too. And yeah. And then that also is so connected to the landscapes we inhabit, right? To the fields and the orchards and to what's happening with weather and climate and development, you know, all these issues impact the things that become our own personal edible memories.
So that's what you mean when you write about that connection between memory and materiality. That she's expressing that, it seems.
Absolutely, absolutely. And part of my work is this interest in how memory can actually shape materiality. So thinking about the sort of the direction of the causal arrow, that what I find is that stories people tell about the past, right, ways that people kind of collectively understand the past, that those in some cases can have a concrete impact on the world we inhabit, mm-hmm. Right? And we can see that in the political sphere. We can see that in terms of memorials and monuments. And then we can also see it in terms of food. So another way to think about the kind of effect of edible memory is that the growth in popularity of things like heirloom tomatoes has had a consequence for the availability of heirloom tomato seed, right? Mm. It has actually increased the access to heirloom tomatoes, and more people are growing more heirloom tomatoes. And so it has potentially a positive effect on biodiversity.
Here's an email from Matt, who writes, "My wife's grandmother kept in her backyard in an Arizonan retirement community a fig tree from which she made the most delicious jam. She was moved out of that house and into an elderly home a couple of years ago, which means no more fig tree, no more fig jam. But Matt writes, luckily my wife took a cutting from that tree and she's cultivating a new plant that will hopefully one day yield our own delicious jam to pass down through the family." You want to say something about that part? Because this idea of, again, preserving the tree itself, you know, to create the fruit, I mean, that is essentially what you're getting at here too.
That's right. It's very intense. And for fruit trees that reproduce with grafting, there's this direct physical connection to the past, right, where generation after generation of grafts have then allowed people to continue to have the flavor, the texture, the look of a fruit that maybe first grew 400 years ago or 300 years ago, right? The tree itself may be long gone, but now because of the ability to graft, we can still be eating those fruits. And so that idea of taking the cutting at this, you know, sort of an emotionally intense moment, right, in a family's life, the sort of change of a parent or a grandparent, you know, leaving their home to bring that fig tree into the future is really powerful to me. And that's happening on an individual level. But we can, again, look at that in sort of the aggregate and think about farmers, you know, or sort of hobby orchardists, people who on a bigger scale bring those flavors of the past up into the future, right? Make them available to us today and to future generations as well.
Matt, thanks a lot. Kelly, thanks to you as well. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address. Again, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Jordan is with us. Her book is Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. And we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the sociologist Jennifer Jordan. We're talking about her book, Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Well, let's talk about tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes, which you point out, of course, there was a time when there wasn't anything called an heirloom tomato. They were just tomatoes. And I hadn't realized for decades, you say, it was practically impossible to buy an heerloom tomato, even though now they're kind of all over the place. Start with heirloom tomatoes, if you would.
Sure. That, as I sort of began to piece together this project, one of the first logical places to look was to simply look at that phrase heirloom tomato,
right,
and to say there must be an origin point. And one really pretty easy way to do that is just to do keyword searches in newspaper databases. And that's what I did. I didn't use the whole sort of collection of all available newspapers. I just did New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, just figuring kind of coastal tastemakers. Let's see what they say and when heirloom tomatoes start showing up. And it's one of the few articles I've ever written where I use tables to show my results. So there's a very clear increase in coverage. And then I could also show a real big change in how people were talking about heirloom tomatoes. So the late 80s, early 90s, that's when heirloom tomatoes start to appear in a little bit of food writing, but almost more garden writing than food writing. And that was one of the first surprises to me, was that – so when I started doing this research in the kind of mid-2000s, mid to late 2000s. By then, heirloom tomato was already a very widely known concept, and there was lots of writing about heirloom tomatoes and even some sort of weariness about heirloom tomatoes. So it was interesting to see, you know, this origin moment, and then to see that it really came out of gardening. So when people were first talking about heirloom tomatoes in these kind of bigger media outlets, that's obviously a sign that this has already been going on elsewhere, right? It takes things a while to bubble up into those media outlets. Of course, some things never bubble up in that way, but the first conversations in these newspapers about heirloom tomatoes were really about growing your own, and very little about restaurants or restaurant reviews. And then there's a big switch toward the end of the 90s where the gardening becomes much less prevalent, the numbers may actually kind of stay the same on gardening, but there's then this big kind of explosion in coverage of heirloom tomatoes for home cooks and then also in restaurants.
And then there comes this moment you also write about, which is interesting, and I'm wondering if this happens in all the time in stories like this. You describe this kind of hollowing out of the heirloom label into this fad. And you write about, I think you were in New York and you had some, you or maybe it was someone in your family had some heirloom tomatoes that you described as underwhelming and overpriced.
That was me in New York.
What did that say to you? I mean, because they had become a fad, and in many ways they had – does this happen in food trends and food tastes where they sort of start small, they really burst onto the scene, and then they become such a fad that on some level they lose their potency in some way?
Sure. I think that's definitely a trajectory that takes place. It's not inevitable and it's not total. Yeah. And so even as heirloom tomatoes do get hollowed out, so anytime you're at a grocery store or a restaurant and they simply list heirloom tomato right on the menu or on the label of the bin at the store and don't have variety names for you, that you should ask, you know, what the varieties are, right? Because part of being an heirloom tomato, right, it has an identifiable name and variety name. And so if the chef or the grocer is not able to tell you that variety name, to me that's an indication that you're possibly operating in the realm of kind of hollowing out the term heirloom tomato. And so I would certainly encourage people encourage people in general to ask more questions about their food, but you can certainly ask, what kind of heirloom tomato is this? And it should have a name. And while that hollowing out is happening, at the same time, right, lots and lots of people are now growing their own heirloom tomatoes and growing their own hybrid tomatoes. And, you know, people are the sort of number of people growing these foods has increased. And then the availability of the seed has also increased quite a bit. So even if we have sort of the hollowing out on one end of the spectrum, we also have sort of continued care and attention to heirlooms by many chefs and by many farmers markets and grocers, and the sort of increased availability of some of those varieties too.
Which just kind of says a lot about our culture. I mean, we get kind of weary of the sort of hipster trend, but it doesn't change the fact that some heirloom tomatoes are great.
Right.
and it's a good thing that there are people with awesome beards growing heirloom tomatoes in the world, right? I want to talk about history because I think you write a terrific bit about the history of the tomato, which you trace the origins of to somewhere in the Andes. So what do we have any sense of what those earliest tomatoes might have been like or tasted like? I mean, you mentioned not many people were interested in them in those days, and they were pretty small, I guess.
They were. And this – I've even asked some – you know, people writing dissertations about tomatoes, if they have more details about those Andean tomatoes. And I haven't gotten much information. It's possible it's out there and I just haven't talked to the right people. But from what I've read, and I think some of this Barry Estabrook writes about in his great book, Tomato Land, but they began just as a small, you know, tiny fruit that no one really wanted to eat. I don't think it was a big part of people's diets. Yeah. And then there's this kind of mysterious gap, again, to the best of my knowledge, that somehow they're then bigger and more edible or more widely eaten in Central America in a while later. Yeah. So they originate in the Andes, but then kind of flourish in Central America.
The Aztecs ate them, and eventually they make their way to Europe. The first we hear of the tomato in Europe, I think you say, is probably around, I think 1544 is how you say. And I guess judging by the food there, this makes sense. The tomato really takes hold in Spain and Italy.
But not for a while.
Yeah.
And that's part of what is fascinating to me also as a sociologist, right? So there's this kind of fundamental physical reality of the food and yet our understanding of it, the meaning we attach to it, what we tell each other about it, really shapes how we interact with it. So because they're in the nightshade family, potatoes and tomatoes were seen as poisonous by many people in Europe for centuries. So these foods that are so essential to so much, not just European cooking, but really global cuisine, right? Tomatoes and potatoes and chili peppers, these things that come from Central America and South America. For a while, certainly in Europe, people want nothing to do with them and grow them as botanical curiosities, but not as sustenance. And even the tomato that's on the cover of my book, as far as I know, was drawn mainly as an illustration of a botanical curiosity rather than as something delicious. And now I look at that tomato and I see something delicious. But I, to the best of my knowledge, at the time that drawing was done in the 17th century, no one was looking at that and thinking about dinner.
Right. And then you talk about how they go from being, you know, so it's eventually it does take hold, obviously. And so how does it go from being, you know, just another vegetable, fruit, I guess, to becoming so diverse with all these different breeds? I mean, that seems like an interesting trajectory, too.
It is. And actually, a lot of what we experience today as heirloom produce emerged in the 19th century. So certainly much of it is older than that.
Yeah.
But a lot of like plant breeding, fruit and vegetable breeding really kind of increased in the 19th century. The 18th century, and this is sort of in terms of Europe and then seeds that Europe was kind of exchanging with the U.S. And in Europe in the 18th century, the aristocracy was really interested in kind of fancy fruit breeding and vegetable mm-hmm. breeding and using that as a way to demonstrate wealth and taste and power and command over resources. And then in the 19th century, in many cases, that became a little bit more of a middle class and in some cases a working class pursuit. In England, there were gooseberry societies where often working class men would, as a hobby, grow gooseberries. And the goal was to grow the biggest possible gooseberry, and that was how you won. And so year after year, people would compete to have grown the biggest gooseberry and work on their plants and try to sort of push the boundaries of gooseberry size. And so that the same kind of energy went toward all kinds of other plants as well. So it's sometimes official kind of scientific research and other times these hobby gardeners and then sort of somewhere in between. And so a whole lot of breeding happened then and a lot of the varieties that we eat today came about in the 19th century.
Well, and then it seems like as technology grows, we get more and more narrow. Because you write about, I think it was in the 19th, this is the 20th century now, in the 30s and the 40s, you write about how agriculture starts to turn away from a wider array of crops. And I guess this is when agribusiness really, really kicks into gear.
That's right. I mean, I think there's some, we need to exercise some caution in thinking about how much biodiversity a given individual was eating. So if we look at the whole food system, the sort of genetic variety of what we were eating definitely shrank in the middle of the 20th century in the U.S. and a little to some extent in Europe as well. But that's – we shouldn't think that, you know, 30 years before that, everyone was eating all kinds of fruits and vegetables,
right?
It was more that there were these regional varieties, right? People were growing for more local markets and so – it wasn't necessarily that a given individual's diet held a whole lot more edible biodiversity, but rather that if we look at the agricultural system as a whole, the kind of number of varieties being grown and then also the focus, the large numbers of a few varieties being grown, that's what we start to see happening.
How are tomatoes different today? And that's a kind of broad question, but one of the things that I noticed sort of intrigued me was you write about how most of the tomato varieties available before the Civil War in this country, they're kind of gone. They've long disappeared. So do we have any idea about what those tomatoes before the war may have been like compared to the tomatoes we're eating today?
That's hard for me to say. I think there are other people who have a better answer than I do just because they've spent even more of their lives investigating those lost flavors and those lost tomatoes and in some cases kind of finding them and bringing them back. It's tough to say in part because actually if you are able to grow tomatoes, you know, if you have the space to do it, if you have the climate to do it, then it's certainly possible to get access to a lot of different tomato flavors and textures that might kind of get you close to how things maybe once were. But that requires a lot of different conditions, right? So you're not going to get those flavors necessarily in a supermarket because it's hard to get those tomatoes to market. And so this is all this sort of balancing act of, you know, demand for tomatoes, demand for perfect tomatoes, and sort of feeding a lot of people those perfect tomatoes versus, you know, different kinds of the tomato varieties available. And so it's all, I guess, in theory, you could have access to something that tasted like a pre-Civil War tomato. In practice, that's going to be a little bit challenging.
What's your sort of final – because I want to move on to apples when we get back to a break. What's your final assessment of the condition of tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes today? Are you seeing – I mean, because you talk about how it's become so many seed varieties that you have access to – Do you sound optimistic about it? Are you pleased with where we seem to be in that way?
Again, that might be a better question for a botanist or a geneticist. But as a sociologist, I see people doing a lot with a lot of different tomatoes, right? And I see them growing tomatoes in very different circumstances, you know, here in Milwaukee in urban farms and gardens, or up north in, you know, these sort of gorgeous farms that I visited in Wisconsin. I see people, you know, finding the tomatoes that work well in their community garden plot or in their small farm. And that's intriguing to me that it does seem like people have some access and, you know, to relatively affordable seed and some ability to find the things that grow well where they are.
Jennifer Jordan is with us. Her book is Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Professor Jennifer Jordan. We're talking about her book, Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take another call from Nancy. Nancy's with us in Ogden. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Hello. It's the first time I've ever been on the air.
Oh, good.
I wanted to mention about heirloom tomatoes. First of all, I never had those growing up. They weren't available where I lived in Illinois. But since then, I have been growing them. And one year I had a bountiful crop of them, all different colors. And I dried some of them. And they turned out to be just beautiful when they're dried. And I froze them. And you can put them on top of casseroles and things. And they're just gorgeous. And I love them. And the other thing was, my mother was a gourmet cook, and there were four of us children, and she fed us some very interesting meals. She was very creative and fixed things like oxtail stew and city chicken legs, Finn and Hattie. I don't know if anybody's familiar with any of those, but some of the things, though, we, us children, kind of made fun of some of the things she fixed because we didn't like them very well. But she cooked every night, made a dessert every night. So we were very well fed. And my sister and I found this book. My mother and father were living in Palm Springs after they retired. We found a book. We were going through a model home, and it's called The Diary of Regrettable Food.
Right.
Are you familiar with this book?
No.
It was just so funny. It was foods from the 50s, mostly. And, like, I heard you describing a certain Jell-O.
Yeah, seafood salad, yeah.
Yes, well, they had a lot of really interesting Jell-Os and photographed and very humorous comments about these foods. And, you know, it's not a cookbook. But we just stood there and laughed reading this book, and we bought it as a birthday present for my older brother.
Good.
And when he was turning 70, and, oh, he loved it.
Yeah.
He just loved it.
A lot of regrettable
food. I really can identify with what you were talking about, yeah. Memories of food.
Yeah, good. Well, again, it goes back to that whole seafood salad thing, Jennifer Jordan.
A seafoam.
Seafoam.
Yeah, yes.
Seafood. That would be even worse. But
Yeah,
seafoam. Yeah, regrettable foods. I'm sure they all fit in there. Did you want to respond to anything she had to say?
Oh, just that to me that illustrates these sort of fluctuations in tastes that are so interesting, right? And the things that a given generation sees as totally normal, fashionable, desirable, and then that may change radically the next generation, and then things may come back around. I think Lucky Peach actually recently, that magazine, had a picture of a two-tiered seafoam salad, and their ingredient list was slightly different from mine, but I started reading it and it was like, wow, okay, my familial seafoam salad is here. And who knew that you could do a two-layer, you know, sort of vertical jello mold with all of that. But I don't think that that means that it's gracing a ton of tables this summer.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But you do write a lot about, I mean, that's an interesting theme in the book where you explore how taste in food changes over time. Give me a sense of how you've come to understand how taste works. Because in the book you say it's really complicated. I mean, there's this mixture of biology and chemistry and habit and memory. It's personal, individual. But did you come to any broader conclusions about the way taste might work?
I did, and in some ways drawing on what some other sociologists have done too. And one way to do that is from a sociological perspective, you can ask questions about where tastes overlap, right? What tastes and foods do people share in a given time and place? And in what ways might people use tastes and food to distinguish themselves from other people or differentiate themselves or to connect themselves to other people? And so that's this French sociologist, Pierre Bourdieu, and he wrote a whole book called Distinction about the kind of sociology of taste and how taste figures in how we identify ourselves. And so this thing that we see is very personal. He writes about taste in food, but also music and visual arts, clothing, right? These very individual choices. He sees them, in his case, he's looking at France in the 1960s, but he sees them as also very connected to people's class backgrounds. And there are people who then have sort of found, you know, critiqued his work and found that it operates differently in the U.S. today. But there is this idea that we can take taste very seriously and use it as a way to understand how we all kind of experience the social world and the material world.
Paul writes this. He writes, "My favorite edible memory is of harvesting figs in my grandparents' yard. These figs were little, about an inch across, incredibly sweet. He says, as a little kid in the family, my job was to climb the tree and get as many figs as I could reach. I still remember my mom fixing homemade fig Newtons and eating them right out of the oven. To this day, I still toast store-bought fig Newtons and eat them warm."
It is. It's a nice kind of compromise.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Paul. Let's talk about apples and the mild epiphany you have. When you're at a farmer's market in Milwaukee, and you come to this wooden crate of apples.
Right. So that was at the West Allis Farmer's Market here in Milwaukee. And again, at a, let's see, relatively early stage in the book. So I had, at that point, I knew a lot about heirloom tomatoes. I didn't know that much about heirloom apples yet. But I was starting to pick up on the fact that they were going to be important. And they actually get a whole chapter in this book. Yeah. And so I'm walking through that farmer's market and suddenly see these apples that I had read about in books and even seen wax models of. So there are all kinds of collections of wax models of apples back from that sort of 19th century era of people breeding new varieties and aiming for kind of fruit perfection. So these wax models were ways to identify different varieties. And so I had seen these models themselves, and then I had read about all kinds of old apples in various books. And so I'm walking through the farmer's market, kind of unsuspecting, and start to read the labels in these crates of apples and realize I'm seeing in the flesh, so to speak, the apples that I had read about. And so I just really stopped in my tracks and started buying up pounds of apples to go see what do these things actually taste like that I've been reading about for a few years.
Mm. You have your own particular apple, a French apple, I think, a strand that you love. It's hard to pronounce. I'm going to give it a shot. Do you want to give it a shot?
Well, it's hard for me to pronounce as well, so I sort of shorten it to the Calville, but the full name is something like Calville Blanc d'Hiver.
Yeah.
And it is a French apple from the late 16th century, and it was, I saw it there at the name of the family is the Westons, so the Weston Orchards farm stand in West Allis, and their orchard is in New Berlin, Wisconsin. So they grow all kinds of apples there, but the Calville quickly became my favorite. And it's, I don't think it's because it's just so old, although that certainly intrigued me. But it's shaped kind of like a bell pepper, so it's an unusual shape for an apple, very lobed. And it has this pale green, almost translucent skin, and it'll get a red kind of pointillist, freckly blush on the sunny side of the apple. And it's very kind of clear tasting. You know, it's tart, but not too tart, and it's very crisp. And those are qualities I like in an apple. I really can't stand mealy apples. And I know other people who are kind of mealiness indifferent, and I really don't like mealy apples. And so the Cavelle is great for that. I can only get them for a few weeks out of the year. So I buy as many as I can and then try to keep them around as long as I can.
Yeah. I love this part you write. Apples are full of human intentionality.
They are. They take a lot of work. And actually, I took a grafting class at Weston Orchards this year.
Wow.
And I also took a pruning class, which was life-changing. But the grafting class, I grafted one apple, and I could barely even do that myself. I pretty much had a lot of help getting that one graft done. And it was the Cavelle. So I thought, okay, there are these piles of scions of the little sticks that are going to form the new apple tree and get grafted onto rootstock. So that was the one I chose, was Cavelle, and grafted it, got it wrapped up in a garbage bag, headed home, and it broke. The graft broke on the way home. And so already I clearly can't be trusted with an apple graft. But I repaired it and was kind of impressed with myself and my repair job, and resealed it with candle wax and, you know, put it in the refrigerator for a few months and planted it. And then a squirrel or somebody broke it again. And so I tried to repair it again, you know, it was in a pot, and the rootstock started leafing out and looked robust and healthy. And it looked like the graft was just done for. Nothing was going to happen. And a couple weeks ago, tiny little leaves came out, and
wow,
it's sprouting now. So somehow it
wow.
survived. So there's that's one example, right? One apple tree that I'm obviously not going to have to depend on for future sustenance, right? The stakes aren't very high on this graft, but there's a lot of human work that goes into getting us the apples that we like to eat.
Let's take another call from Lisa, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to be on. I've been really enjoying the program, but there's one very local culture that kind of has gotten skipped over, and that is, I think, pretty much predominantly LDS food. And one particular example is funeral potatoes. When my uncle died, I went to his funeral, and everyone came to the social hall afterward with potluck food to feed everybody. And we had 14 dishes of identical funeral potatoes.
Oh, my goodness.
They were all the same recipe, did
all
you say?
All the same recipe.
Yeah.
There's only one recipe for funeral potatoes.
I guess that's true. Jennifer Jordan, do you know anything about the Mormon funeral potatoes? It's quite a thing here.
I do not know anything about Mormon funeral potatoes, but I am very glad to know about them.
Yeah.
And I recently went to a funeral here in Milwaukee where we also went into literally the church basement, you know, underneath the church itself. Right. And just I was stunned by the collection of homemade food and, you know, nothing store-bought that I could see, and just all of this kind of love and care and nurturing for the mourning family. And that's not something that I experienced growing up myself. So it was really powerful to see the way that, you know, 14 dishes of identical potatoes, or in this case, lots of desserts with rhubarb just because of the season that we were in, you know, that becomes a way to care for people and a thing that you just do kind of. And predominantly women, you know, most of the people doing the cooking for that funeral were the women of the church. And it's just very kind of understood that you take the time to make these things for people when they need them.
You write about for every historical orchard, there are countless of forgotten orchards. And this is how you put it in the book. You say abandoned orchards provide a tangible way to think about that dynamic relationship between remembering and forgetting. And that's kind of where I want to leave off today, because you write about this concept called edible forgetting. Would you talk about that?
Sure. That comes out of also some of my earlier research in Berlin, you know, a very different context and very different kind of set of spaces. But this idea that things can happen in places, and those places aren't necessarily going to tell you their story. You can pick up clues, though. And so the forgotten orchards can... And the forgotten orchard is both a real place and kind of a metaphor.
Sure.
But if we take an actual forgotten orchard, so a stand of fruit trees, and let's take apple trees, right? So apple trees did not originate in the United States. They did not originally grow wild here. And so usually when you see apple trees growing, it can be a sign that people planted them, right? That, to go back to that human intentionality issue. And when you see abandoned apple trees, that can mean that sort of the world changed around those trees, right? That nobody needs them anymore, that a single family left or maybe a whole community left for various reasons, right? For reasons that go way beyond just those apples. And I think we have a lot to learn by asking about kind of past agricultural landscapes, past edible landscapes in our own families, but also as a society, as a culture, and to think about, you know, the particular arrangement we have today of fields and orchards and gardens is of a moment, right? And it's not necessarily going to be this way in the future, and it doesn't look like how things looked in the past. And we have a lot to learn by examining that contrast.
Jennifer Jordan, her book is called Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods. She teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, joined us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.